From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Michigan hears from the U.S. Supreme Court, fix your sex offender registry law.
It's an incredible opportunity. I mean, getting laws passed, changed, is difficult in any place. But now, the legislature has to do something.
How scammers are taking advantage of the Michigan estate law, snatching properties out of the hands of rightful heirs.
This real estate speculator is scouring the delinquent tax records and the death notices, and then looking for properties that have some value.
Michigan bankers brace for the fallout from the Equifax data breach.
By and large, if consumers are diligent, they won't eat the costs of the fraud losses, but the banks will.
And we'll have local spins with music from West Michigan. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump visited Puerto Rico today, and we're going to learn more about efforts in Michigan to send supplies to people on that devastated island. Michigan's estate planning laws are being manipulated in unethical and predatory ways that are not illegal. We'll hear from Oakland County's treasurer about what's happening and why he believes that has to change. But first, the Supreme Court opened its October term yesterday, and one of its first actions has direct repercussions for Michigan. The Supreme Court decided it would not take up the state of Michigan's appeal of a unanimous decision by the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. 13 months ago, that appeals court found the state was treating people as moral lepers with its sex offender registry. With us now is University of Michigan law professor J.J. Prescott, who's an expert on sex offender laws. J.J., welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me.
Remind us, first of all, how we got here. What did the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals unanimously decide?
Sure. The story actually goes back a little bit. So the ACLU filed a lawsuit years ago now challenging various aspects of the sex offender registry law in the state of Michigan. They brought a number of arguments to the table. One of them was that the law could not be applied retroactively to people who had been convicted of laws at an earlier time. So the ACLU brought a number of arguments to the table. One was that the laws were essentially punitive, which means that the laws can't be applied retroactively to people who had been convicted of sex offenses at some previous time.
But the state was doing that.
But the state has been doing that, and lots of states have been doing that. And this argument is not a new one. The reason why the ACLU brought it now is because the registry law and how it's being applied in Michigan has been so expansive and comprehensive that the ACLU argued it really kind of crossed the line into being a punitive measure. They also brought a number of other arguments, too. And actually, that argument about the punitive nature of the law was thrown out actually rather early. The judge at the district court passed on that argument. Instead, he wound up finding that the laws suffered because of vagueness and a number of other issues, often some smaller issues, but ultimately found the laws to be unconstitutional in certain regards. The state then appealed to the Sixth Circuit, and the Sixth Circuit actually wound up not even ruling on those issues that the lower court judge had focused on, and instead had returned to this idea about the laws being excessively punitive, and decided on the basis of this case brought by six individuals that indeed the laws can't be applied to them because it violates ex post facto restriction of the Constitution.
And the high court said, goodbye us. We're not taking up the state's appeal.
That's right. So the Supreme Court, in some sense, didn't do much other than decide they are not going to hear the case, which means for all intents and purposes, the decision is final.
What have people on the registry been able to do or not do under Michigan's laws?
There are many restrictions that apply. First and foremost, and some of the classic restrictions are that you have to provide information about where you're living, identifying information to the state, which is then made public. And in many ways, that has all sorts of repercussions. So it becomes difficult for people to find jobs, difficult for them to find housing, difficult for them to form new relationships. All of those things we actually think are quite important for them not returning to crime. But on top of that, there are a bunch of other restrictions. So there are certain jobs that you can't be a part of. You can't live in certain places. So there are what we call exclusionary laws that say if you're a convicted sex offender, you can't live near schools or other types types of businesses. And some of those exclusionary areas are so large that they effectively banish people from certain towns and cities.
And certainly when the law was being crafted, I'm sure the argument was we're going to make everybody safe. But you and others argue that these harsh laws that we've had in Michigan actually diminish public safety rather than increase it?
That's right. I mean, in many ways, it is counterintuitive. I mean, the first common sense reaction to these laws is, wow, I mean, it seems like they ought to help. And certainly, or at the very least, they can't make things worse, right? And these are people who have committed a crime. If it's hard on them, so be it. As long as it might make us safer, that's fine. But what we forget is actually, in many ways, these laws operate as anti-reentry laws. In other words, they make life so difficult, even for those who never would have committed a crime again, that it's actually not all that different from being in prison. And if you think about how somebody who is homeless or can't find a job or can't see or interact with their family very often because of all of these restrictions, turns out that a number of them start to wonder, you know, what's in it for them? Why should they continue trying hard to reintegrate into society given how difficult it is for them to be on the outside? If there's anything we're looking for that sort of makes this point, think about what we do for other criminals who have committed a crime and have now been released. We spend a lot of time trying to help them reintegrate into society, try to help them move on. These laws, especially the notification laws that go out of our way to sort of remind everybody that they were a past sex offender, making it very difficult for them to fit back into society, really does the opposite of what we normally do with most categories of released offenders.
So now that, as you've explained, the Supreme Court's decision, or its decision not to decide, means Michigan has to go back to the drawing boards. What models around the country do you think could serve as guides for Michigan lawmakers and officials that would ensure public safety, but also uphold constitutional rights?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I mean, I think this decision does mean that Michigan has to do something, and that means it's an incredible opportunity. I mean, getting laws passed, changed, is difficult in any place, but now the legislature has to do something. An obvious first step is starting to hold hearings, putting together a working group to start to talk about options. There are plenty of other models out there. So, you know, certain things that other states do that Michigan does not do, for example, is focus on risk. So right now, your crime of conviction determines your treatment. So even if you're 95 years old and you're convicted of a crime that only a young person really commits, doesn't really matter. We don't focus on whether we think you're realistically a threat. So more carefully targeting some of the application of these laws and restrictions to people where we actually think it will make a difference is an obvious direction to go. Probably shrinking the scope of these things generally is likely to lead to a lot of people who we think have real prospects for reintegrating into society to encourage them to be successful and to make Michigan safer as a result.
University of Michigan Law Professor J.J. Prescott, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The oldest baby boomers are now 71, the youngest 53. Which means ahead of us, there's a big wave of senior citizens who'll be needing services. Lester Graham, reporting for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, explains that right now in Detroit, many of those seniors rely on informal networks of neighbors, family, or friends.
Many senior citizens end up living on their own. In Detroit, 41% of people over 60 live alone, according to a report by Data Driven Detroit. That's the case with Ida Brown. She lives in a house in the Morningside neighborhood of Detroit. She's lived there for 3 years, but she says she really hasn't gotten to know her neighbors.
I might could if I was more outgoing with people, but I just have never in my life been the person that goes and talk a lot to other people, you know. If they don't seem interested too much in me, I leave them alone. I don't bother.
Brown is in her 80s, and recently she got a new neighbor across the street. Ted Shoemaker says he wanted to get to know the people who live in Morningside.
You know, I try to reach out to my neighbors. I've got a lot of, I know pretty much everyone within a 4 to 5 house radius on my block.
That includes Ida Brown.
I met him, yeah. You know, he was friendly, but you know, I don't bother you when you're not too friendly.
Shoemaker checks in on her. So does her daughter. She takes her to the grocery store and to appointments. Not all senior citizens are that fortunate. Marianne Frazier owns M&D Pharmacy. She says a lot of her older customers are unable to leave home even to pick up a prescription. She adds it appears too many of these seniors are alone and no one is checking on them.
A lot of times I don't think so. So my delivery girl checks on them. And I talked to them on the phone.
Frazier started those deliveries specifically for the elderly shut-ins in the surrounding neighborhoods. In the same building next to the pharmacy, Betty Wright has opened a senior daycare center. She's named it Tobe Mac. She's a retired nurse and physician's assistant and wants to help seniors be active. So far, Wright is not being swamped with paying customers.
Well, right now, no one's paying. And that's okay.
Wright used her own savings to launch the Tobe Mac Senior Daycare Center. The rent? Well, pharmacist Marianne Frazier owns the building, and rent payments are, let's say, she's allowing a delay. Wright is frustrated because so far the agencies that could make funds available say they are out of money. The center is cozy with nice furniture provided by Wright. It's like a tiny hotel lobby with additional spaces for exercise and craft activities. A group of women are chatting in an area decorated with some of their own art. Mamie Walker is a friend of Betty Wright's and a big advocate of getting this senior center off the ground.
We are all getting older, and we need a place where we can come, socialize, have Bible study, have exercise, being able to communicate with one another, and it's a relaxing place. Gives you peace of mind.
The other women nod in agreement. Betty Wright says for seniors who spend a lot of time alone, the little things mean a lot.
Just sitting with someone and chatting with them, I mean, it's so interesting to be in the midst of maybe three or four. Everyone wants to talk at the same time because they don't have a lot of opportunities to talk.
There's an economic argument for funding senior centers like this. Active seniors usually stay in their homes longer. That means a stay in the nursing home is shorter. At an average cost of $7,500 a month, almost 32% of all Medicaid goes to long-term care. Seniors who have Medicaid can get a waiver for senior daycare, which is much cheaper. But in a city of 700,000, Detroit only has about 20 senior daycare centers. Some of those operate out of houses. Detroit is a city where putting something together out of nothing to meet a need is normal. There's an old saying, making a way out of no way. It's how many neighborhoods take care of their people. For the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. At least 4 million Michiganders have had their data compromised in the Equifax hack. Coming up, a banking expert tells us what we can do to protect ourselves. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The now former CEO of Equifax is testifying today before the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Richard Smith is apologizing for the huge data breach, blaming it on human error and technology failures, which is small consolation to the more than 145 million people whose names, social security numbers, birth dates, even driver's license numbers were exposed to hackers. More than 4 million of those folks are here in Michigan. And trying to figure out just how to protect yourself can be confusing. Mike Tierney is president and CEO of Community Bankers of Michigan, and he's with us now. Mike, I know your group just wrapped up its annual convention and trade show. What are members saying about this Equifax breach?
Well, it's a very unfortunate situation for all the customers of our banks here in Michigan, and it puts a huge burden on the banks because the fraud losses that will take place, by and large, if consumers are diligent, they won't eat the costs of the fraud losses, but the banks will. So there's a huge cost to everyone, and eventually it leads to higher prices for everyone, right? So these kinds of things do matter.
Equifax waited 6 weeks to tell the public about this data breach. As someone in the banking business, what was your reaction to that?
You know, it is common with data breaches to not know the full extent of them right away. They did hire an outside firm, Mandiant, to come in and take a look, dig into it deeper. As you may be aware, they just updated their numbers, and they've found, as a result of that outside review, another 2.5 million people that were impacted. So the number is now up to 145.5 million. And if you think about that, a data breach of 2.5 million records on its own would be huge. It's unprecedented to have 145 million people impacted.
What will happen with that stolen data? I guess even more personally, what kind of damage can these hackers inflict on someone's life?
Well, that data gets distributed on the web, especially in the dark web, and consumers need to be aware that it may be years before they're impacted. You know, I wouldn't expect that there'll be much impact right away, but it is going to happen over the next 24 months. So the two main things that'll happen is people will try to get access to your accounts and try to take funds out of accounts, and then they'll also try to apply for credit in your name. And frankly, consumers, you know, we just have to be more diligent. In this digital age, the reality is, with bank checking account statements, more consumers do not open them than do open them. And it's just not the way you can live anymore. If you open your statements and you look and you get in contact with your bank and you see something that's out of whack, you are protected. But typically you have 60 to 90 days to notify whether it's a bank, any financial services entity that you're with. And if you don't notify them in that time, you've lost your important protection.
So open the envelope. Don't just let it sit there. I can hear you say that.
Check online, open the envelopes, be diligent, and not only of your own consumer information, but these credit thieves will take the information of your children. They'll take the information of the elderly. So whoever's important in your life, make sure that either they're checking or if they don't have the capacity to check, you're checking on their behalf.
Mike, what about this advice to freeze our credit, which people found a lot of problems trying to get on the websites of the three credit reporting agencies to do that? Couldn't even get online. Is that something that you would advise people to do?
They have a couple of different things they can do. First thing is be diligent. Second thing is you can do a fraud alert. That's a step below a credit freeze. The fraud alert will notify you if someone is accessing your credit report. The step that might be actually more convenient and still do what you want. The next step is you can do a credit freeze or what's often called a security freeze. If you do that, there's typically a charge $5 to $10, which is minimal, so it shouldn't prevent you from doing it. But just keep in mind, for instance, I went to the Equifax website. My information was hacked. I thought about doing the credit freeze, but I didn't, because I know I'm going to buy a new car in the next 60 days, and I know that would be a hassle with the credit freeze trying to do that. So I will do a credit freeze, but I won't do it until after I apply for the credit and I get the new car. The other thing they should do is they should file their tax returns early, because the scammers will try to file early, get their refund. Now, you can still work through the IRS to get your refund when you prove that it's been a scam, but you have to go through all the work to prove it's a scam. You're going to wait months for your refund. So most of us are procrastinators. We don't want to file till April 15th. I used to pride myself on dropping it in the Royal Oak Post Office at midnight on the 15th. But again, it's one of these things, you just can't do this anymore. You know, you want to file as soon as possible, especially if you're expecting to get a refund. You don't want to let a scammer get it before you get your hands on it. Another step you can take that some people are doing right now is they're contacting their financial service firms and they're having them reissue new cards. So they're getting new debit cards, new credit cards, because the thieves don't have that information. So the information they got were names, Social Security numbers, birth dates, addresses, and in some cases, driver's licenses. They didn't get, in this particular hack, credit card numbers. Well, they did for 200,000 people. And they did get dispute docs on another 180,000 people. So that number didn't get compromised here, but when these ID thieves get your information, they'll go to multiple sources for information, and they'll put that information together. So even if they didn't get it from Equifax, they'll try to get it from someplace else, match it up. If you really want to go the most aggressive step, contact your financial institutions, have them reissue new cards, and change your PINs.
Mike Tierney, President, CEO of the Community Bankers of Michigan. Thank you so much for sharing advice with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Time now to check out West Michigan's music scene. As we say, hello again to John Sinkovich, who's editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com, a website covering West Michigan's music scene. It's always great to have you with us, John.
Wonderful to be back. And considering the turbulence and the turmoil and the violence that we seem to be enduring on an almost weekly basis, I'm glad to say that I've chosen a couple of artists who display the healing power of music, and their latest albums certainly are part of that.
Well, we'll take that. We're going to start with a singer-songwriter who certainly is no stranger to us here on Stateside. We've talked with her. She has a devout following all over Michigan. I like the fact you call her Michigan's de facto queen of indie folk, May Earlywine, out with a new album, Mother Lion.
Yeah, she really is, over the last 15 years or so, just because of her talent, her collaborative nature, her amazing songwriting, and of course her voice, has really become sort of the standout indie folk artist of the region. And, you know, everything from when she started under the name Daisy May, to her collaborations with Seth Bernard, to more, you know, even working with a bunch of other female vocalists as part of the Sweetwater Warblers. She's also toured not too long, as of late, with a dance party soulful band called The Motivations. She really has set the bar for other artists, I think, and she's gotten attention nationally as well for her song Shine On. She resides in the Traverse City area, and she's part of that Earthwork Music Collective that's certainly well-respected. And it's really interesting that she decided this time around to sort of change things up a little bit. She's got a different band in the studio with her. She ended up bringing in several members from Ann Arbor's Wolfpack, which is more of a funk band, interestingly enough. But she brought them into the studio to record this. And Tyler Duncan, the producer, really did a marvelous job of incorporating a few new sounds at the same time really maintaining that wonderful indie folk sound that she has.
Well, let's listen to some of the fantastic first single, Never One Thing.
Never one thing, no, not one thing at all. I'm the underbelly, I am the claw.
Boy, talk about prolific. What, more than 15 albums in the past 15 years?
Yes, and that probably doesn't count anything that she's done with a lot of other artists. She appears as a guest artist on other artists' works as well. And she just is just, when you go to one of her concerts, you can't help but go away feeling better about life in general, which is why I really think it's important that people hear this album. I mean, she says that it was inspired by times of love, anger, joy, sorrow, dissonance, harmony, compassion, rebellion, grief, healing, togetherness, isolation. You know, I just interviewed her about this, and she says she just wanted to build a soundtrack that embraces all of that. And I think she's done a wonderful job. And it's interesting, too, that she's actually doing kind of a dual release. She's actually going to first release it in Michigan starting this week. And then in November, she'll digitally release it nationally. She really wanted to reward her Michigan fans. And it starts off with a CD release show at Bay Theater in Suttons Bay on Friday. Then she plays Grand Rapids at St. Cecilia Music Center on Saturday and continues that with several other shows throughout Michigan over the next month.
Let's take a quick listen to a little bit more off this new album, Mother Lion, from May Earlywine. This is Fine Line.
I'm afraid this is what we're made of. I'm afraid we will never wake up. And I want to feel it. It's a fight.
Next up, we have Desmond Jones. Tell us about this jam band. Where are they based?
So they're based in Grand Rapids. They actually first got together in East Lansing, a bunch of students from Michigan State University, and they eventually relocated here. And they've really worked hard on developing their live show. They're a jam band. They take jazz and rock and funk and really make it a fun party for their audiences whenever they play. They actually had a year-long residency here at a nightclub in Grand Rapids, and I think they really helped them hone their sound. I'm really happy to see that they finally put out a full-length album, and they're doing that starting later this week, as a matter of fact. And they've really kind of incorporated a lot of that live sound feel into what they've done. They recorded at In Muso Studios in Weberville with Kevin McKay, with mixing by Alex Gauthier, and of course mastering by Glenn Brown, who's very well known. And these guys just really do a great job of incorporating several different eclectic styles into their music.
Now your lives I won't save, I live for the gold till the grave. But little as we are against the waves, I'm still just a knave who won't give up now, not after years at the bow. But to have it all, I must find a crew that I trust. Given a chance, I'd choose it again. Anything short of my death is a sin. What kind of guy have I been? What kind of guy have I been?
That's Gold Till the Grave off the new release from Desmond Jones. So they're going to be playing around the state, right?
They're officially releasing the album October 10th. They play a show Friday at the Avenue Cafe in Lansing this week, and a CD release show this Saturday at Founders Brewing in Grand Rapids. And I assure you, they're going to be doing a lot more touring because these guys love to play. They just got back from New York, I know, and they'll be playing a couple of shows in Traverse City later this month. They're a fun band to see live.
And now we turn to Grand Rapids singer-songwriter Cameron Blake, the new album Fear Not. Tell us about Cameron. Very interesting backstory.
He's a classically trained violinist. He turned to folk music after getting his master's degree in performance from the Peabody Institute of Music. He came back to Michigan, where he's from originally, and he became a church music director. And when we talked about healing at the top of this segment, he really tackles a lot of difficult, tougher issues and the darker side of life. But in a lot of ways, it's very hopeful. The new album is titled Fear Not. It really tackles a lot of things having to do with fear and overcoming fear. He brought nearly 50 musicians together for various parts of this album, so it's a very lush production. Covers subject matter ranging from the Tiananmen Square protest to late actor Philip Seymour Hoffman to a Baltimore riot. And he's really never been afraid to tackle these sorts of issues and find ways to really express that in his music. His 2015 album, Alone on the World Stage, made a lot of best of year lists. He's toured overseas in the UK and certainly gotten some attention outside of Michigan.
And here's the first single from Cameron Blake's new album. It's After Sally.
The fog is lifted and the sky is blue. The river swollen, almanacs confused. Will the flowers be dressed in their Easter time best for you? Spring is late, but our love is strong. Old lazy river moves the ice along. It's too real to accept when no words can express what we've gone through. Big black skies filling up with stars. Our chimneys puffing like a cold cigar. We hung together under the pressure. Someone told me that's our hearts apart. We took the road with all the men. We buckled down until the highway ends. We took the road with all the bands. And something's gotta give. Something's gotta give. Something's gotta give me wings.
Really, as you say, a sizable cast of contributors. It really gives it something to have so many, some 50 different musicians kicking in on this.
Absolutely, and compared to his last album, which was a very raw, very personal, done pretty much solo, it's really interesting to see him put this big production together. The new album officially gets released November 17th. He's already released a couple of singles. I know Huffington Post described one of them as poetic and filled with luminous melancholy, and I'd have to agree, but I did pick a track or two here that are more upbeat and up-tempo from the new album, and I really love the way in which he writes and the way in which he really expresses an antidote to fear.
Well, as a matter of fact, speaking of a different tempo and a different feel, here's some of the gospel-flavored Queen Bee.
I was a stranger in a stranger's land, in no position to leave. I was a stranger in a stranger's land, and then the Queen Bee sent a message to me.
said I'll move you up, my darling. I'll move you up as far as I can see. Yes, I'll move you up, my darling. I'll move you up if you start working for me.
Now, will we see Cameron performing around Michigan so people can catch him?
Eventually, we hope so. I'm hoping he'll be in contact with us and he's setting something up as he goes. And I think he's really interesting because when he does a lot of his shows live, he definitely brings in other people to help him out. His shows tend to be an experience.
So to recap, Cameron Blake, Fear Not is the latest release. Desmond Jones, self-titled album, and May Earlywine's newest release, Mother Lion. And you can find out more about these and other West Michigan artists by going to localspins.com, edited and published by my guest, John Sinkovich. John, it's always a blast. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, as President Trump visits hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico, we'll speak with a Michigander organizing a relief effort for the island. And there's a loophole in Michigan's estate laws being exploited to take property out of the hands of rightful heirs. We'll hear how officials are trying to fix that. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump is spending this day in Puerto Rico, getting a firsthand look at the destruction wrought by Hurricane Maria and meeting with officials, with storm victims and first responders. Meanwhile, Puerto Ricans living here in Michigan keep worrying about family and friends back on the island. Rose Figuera has taken her worry and channeled it into co-founding a group to help. It is called Puerto Rico Rises Ann Arbor. Welcome, Rose. And first of all, have you been able to connect with all your family?
Yes.
And how long did that take? What was it like until you could get word?
So it's interesting because I was one of the 1%, I think, that my dad was able to call me through FaceTime while the storm was happening. But then I lost contact for days. That worries a lot. 95% of my friends were not able to communicate until last week.
And what was that like to be here so far away and not knowing what the status was with family at home?
It's really sad and it was worrisome because we're all on Facebook and social media and the first thing we see is, I'm telling you, all the posts on Facebook were my friends asking about a specific neighborhood. Have you heard about this neighborhood? Have you heard about this town? Or have you heard about this family? A friend just told me that 3 days ago was when she was able to communicate with her mom. And even them, they're saying, oh, we're okay, it's fine, even though that they lost their roof and things like that. But they just see the person right next to them that it's worse, and they're like, no, it's okay.
What about your family? How did they weather the storm?
My dad specifically had, they were like 8 people at his house, and he had a generator. So for the beginning, it was good. They were trying to help other people, you know, giving connection cords to others. The issue with them was that, quoting him, he said, well, we never lose water because we're connected to the main hospital. So it's the Centro Médico. And so he didn't collect any water. So he had 8 people at his house, and they didn't have water because they did lose water for the first time. The people that were staying at his house, they actually lost everything in their house and also in their work. So they were, you know, that was something not planned. They had to stay with him. So it's just...
Suddenly the world has changed.
Exactly. It's way different.
Can you describe for us what the Puerto Rican community in Michigan is like?
Well, there's... a lot of Puerto Ricans that I didn't know. So it's big. It could be from hundreds around campus and in Ann Arbor, either staff, alumni, students, undergrads and graduate students. Mm-hmm. But also they're in different parts of Michigan, mainly because of all the people in the auto industry, all the engineers, at least that's how I started connecting with them. For example, I know that there's about 130 or more in GM only. And they're all collecting items for us. And the same goes for Toyota, Chrysler, you know, like, so right. All these places, the word of mouth, this started just with the word of mouth, like, we're going to start collecting things until it got solidified. And they were already, you know, spreading the word and actually collecting items. So right now we are actually have places in Livonia, Macomb, Canton, Ann Arbor, Northville, MSU, Bowling Green, Michigan State. So it's not only like a Michigan thing. This actually spread out throughout the whole...
beyond Ann Arbor.
Exactly.
And I'm sure as powerless as you were feeling, then you take that and everybody that you are talking about in Michigan's Puerto Rican community had that feeling of, oh my God, I've got to do something.
Exactly. Yeah, we felt helpless at the beginning. And then this is a way also to help the people here in the diaspora. So it's like we are here, we feel that we cannot help at all. And then suddenly we see, wait, no, we have a lot of tools and we can actually help even more. We served as communicators. We served as donating items, spreading the word. So we have a lot of tools and we're trying to take advantage and look united, you know, like it's Michigan for Puerto Rico.
And social media certainly is helping you spread the word
exactly.
Of A, the need, and B, what people can do to donate. And I'm sure that there is a sense that people do want to help.
Exactly, yes.
And they want to know that their donation will go to people in need. And you're not looking for money, right? You're looking for items.
Yes, we're looking for items. Well, mainly, I would say there's two or three main reasons. One is the simple one, that after all, you know that things, it's an island. Things have to be shipped. Either air or shipping containers, cargo. So they need to go there at some point. So in our case, we decided to join Puerto Rico Rises. So what we did is we partnered with a nonprofit in New York that is the people that have been working with the Empire State Relief Fund with the government of New York. So they're actually collecting items and they're partnered with the government as well. So for example, our stuff are going to be received in a military base in New York. And then the nonprofit is going to be in charge to send it to Puerto Rico.
So you don't have to pay to get this the donations? You just get the donations to New York? Is that the idea?
No, exactly. And we're not even paying for this stuff getting from Michigan to New York because we are getting a lot of help from major auto companies to get that set up. Right now, I know Ford is trying to set that one of the transportation. The second thing about collecting items instead of money is that after all, you have companies, and I'll give you the example of Ford because I was just talking to the people today to set up the transportation. They're helping. They're actually having matching 200,000, I believe, in donations, like monetary donations, to give to the people in Puerto Rico. So these companies usually set a specific quantity, and then that would be it. But then we came with this initiative, and then we say, hey, can you help us with transportation, with tangible items? Can you help us, your employees, collecting stuff? And they keep saying yes and yes and different things that otherwise it would have been capped with just those $200,000. So it's maximizing the resources that we have.
Give me an idea of the kinds of items that I'm gathering. You've got this wish list because it's what people most need, such as...
Well, it's a tropical island, so mosquito repellent is one of the things that we need the most. The dengue fever, Zika are things that we expect that are going to start rising with all the water. Other items would be, I know from firsthand because I have been helping people to get adult diapers, for example, to elderly homes there. And that's something that we have been struggling. We have been from here calling to FEMA and other places because we know specific places that are in need right now in the middle of the island. And they cannot communicate, they cannot call, they cannot be sitting and calling FEMA for hours until they pick up because we know they're busy right now.
They're swamped, yeah, okay.
So they need us over here in the U.S. to help them do those calls and call in their behalf. So we keep gathering that information. There's meetings with a lot of thousands of Puerto Ricans around the U.S.,
And people are hearing what's needed.
Exactly.
As you say, you talk
and
to someone at home.
Collect.
Puerto Rico is now in the minds of people who maybe hadn't really, they don't have family there. They don't have personal ties there, but they have seen the devastation.
Yeah.
What do you think you and others in the Puerto Rican community can do to kind of keep the attention on the island and its people? What might this mean in the long run?
So that's a great question. We have the conference calls with hundreds of Puerto Ricans and meetings that have been around the U.S. One group came up with something that it's been spread out in social media. It's called 100 Days for Puerto Rico. And it's basically each day you have a task. It could be as simple as share this link or call your representative and ask for an extension of the waiver for the Jones Act. Things like that. But it's tangible things each day, simple. It only takes you 5 minutes at most. but you keep the momentum going for at least these 100 days.
Well, you can learn more about the donation drive, the items needed, dates, the drop-off spots around Southeast Michigan by going to the website puertoricorises.com/Ann Arbor. And you are the group for Michigan. So
yes,
for people in Michigan who want to help in a solid way, puertoricorises.com/Ann Arbor. Rose Figueroa is the co-organizer of Puerto Rico Rises Ann Arbor. Rose, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Some old-fashioned sleuthing by the treasurer and clerk of Oakland County turned up a scheme manipulating Michigan's estate law, a scheme unethical, predatory, and not illegal. And that's why Oakland County Treasurer Andy Meisner is speaking out to alert people all over the state it could happen to you. And he's supporting a pair of bills that would change Michigan's estate law. Andy Meisner, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
So these are two bills that were introduced into the State House, HB 4821 and 4822. They have just passed committee, so they're now headed to the House. And you're saying, oh, yes, we need these bills. We need to change Michigan's estate law. Why?
You know, we have rightful heirs who are falling victim to a very unscrupulous conspiracy that involves a real estate speculator and somebody called a public administrator who is a part of the state probate court system.
So this is a state-appointed official?
It is. It's appointed by the Attorney General. And the idea behind the public administrator is where there is no family and there are no heirs, the public administrator then comes in and administers the estate.
Okay.
What's happening here, however...
Yeah, what'd you uncover?
...is that there are rightful heirs, and these guys are working together to exclude them and to cut them out of their rightful inheritance. And the way we found out about it is that we had relatives who overcame the grief of losing their relative, recognized that there were delinquent taxes on mom or dad's property, took the responsible step of coming to our office, worked out a monthly payment plan to take responsibility for this debt that they probably didn't even know about. And then we said, okay, we're not going to take the property because you have a payment plan. We're all good. They then get an eviction notice from this real estate company saying that they have to leave the property. And so they contact us and they say, Andy, what is going on?
You know, you said we were good.
Right. And so what we came to find out is that this real estate speculator is scouring the delinquent tax records and the death notices and then looking for properties that have some value. And then the guy would tip off the public administrator, one in particular who has since been let go, and say, hey, this would be a good one for you to initiate an estate on. And by the way, when you do it, why don't you hire me not only to manage the property, but to sell the real estate and to provide other ancillary services, which they bill the estate for, and they do so in a very excessive fashion. We have instances where they completely excluded the rightful heirs. We testified in the House Judiciary Committee on these bills recently, and I sat with a woman named Miss D'Angelo. While it was about $40,000 in the estate, her and her brother got like $1,000 or $1,500. And so it is beyond unscrupulous.
And I take it the real estate broker who says, now I'll take care of selling this. And then what are we doing? Splitting some of that with the public administrator? People are clearly making money off this.
Yeah, the public administrator took $5,000 for her work in this D'Angelo case and then told Ms. D'Angelo, said, normally my fee would be $25,000. I'm going to give you a break and do it for $5,000. And so we noticed this happening around Oakland County. There were other instances in the region.
How many did you find?
We had about a dozen cases just in Oakland County. And I heard from a friend in the real estate community who said that there are now seminars that are teaching this conspiracy. These bills will shut them down and make certain that not only do we protect property rights in Michigan, but that we don't prey on people. I mean, I lost a dad, and it was very difficult. You know, you're not necessarily thinking about anything other than the grief of that loss. And the takeaway here is that what you have to think about if you lose a relative is that there is an estate, and it requires action on your part. You know, right now under the current law, you only have 42 days to file a probate estate. And if you don't do that, then the public administrator can do it. We are extending that to 90 plus days.
So just basically, if there are heirs, you're giving heirs more time.
Yeah.
Because to back up what this practice is, this scheme, I can certainly tell just from your expression, it's predatory.
Yes.
unethical, but not currently illegal.
Yeah, Cindy, that's right. It's in a gray area where it is exactly as you described. And so we need a little bit of a statutory fix just to make absolutely clear that not only is this illegal, but a part of these bills, sponsored by Jim Runstead, a state representative from Oakland County who's chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and Jim Ellison, it's a bipartisan package, that it is going to explicitly be a crime to do this. And so prosecutors will be able to go after them. It really has been a great bipartisan effort.
What else does it do besides lengthening that time?
So you have the time frame. The other thing that you have is notice. In one of the cases that we had, there were three sisters who were right in Oakland County that somehow the public administrator failed to connect with. It's like, really, you know, so the notice requirement, in other words, the requirement to notify potential heirs that this estate is out there, we beef that up significantly. And so we're requiring that they be informed of their rights and that they don't get snowed under by this awful conspiracy. Another piece is that there's a remarkable lack of transparency in the probate system. The probate judge is overseeing the process, but the public administrator doesn't really have to carefully account for their expenses, other bills that they attach to the estate. And so what our bills are going to do is make it more explicit that the judge not only has an oversight responsibility, but that those documents are going to be public and are going to be very clear, so that if we've got somebody who is charging a 4% real estate commission, and on both sides, if they're charging huge sums for the public administrator, then they're going to have to get that through the judge, and it's going to have to survive the transparency of sunlight.
Amazing what some sunlight can do.
Yeah, well, we're hopeful of that. And then lastly was the thing that I referenced, is just that this will be added as a criminal offense in Michigan. You know, when you talk to people about it and you describe what happens, they're like, my God, that has got to be against the law. Well, you know, that is not crystal clear, but with these bills passing, that will become a crime in Michigan, and we will shut down this operation. We will make certain that heirs can focus first and foremost on grieving for their loved ones, and then in a reasonable amount of time, they can work to preserve their relatives' estate.
As you say, the bills have passed out of committee. They are headed to the House. They are bipartisan. So is there your sense that the political interest and will is there through the legislature pass this?
You know, we, the county clerk in Oakland and I reached out to the Oakland County legislative delegation on both sides of the aisle. We got a fantastic response from both sides, and they have been unbelievably helpful. The Attorney General's office has been very helpful in this as well. And so I am very hopeful that they will pass out of the House, pass the Senate, and then receive the governor's signature, and we will shut down these unscrupulous actors and make sure that that sort of thing doesn't happen again.
Oakland County Treasurer Andy Meisner. You and County Clerk Lisa Brown did some detective work, and it seems to have paid off. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, and Danielle Pryor. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.